Welcome to the B-Side. It is Tyler Crawford here, as always, with our senior pastor at 12 Lions Church, Steve Croker.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Well, it's Monday.
Yeah, but hey, it's good. Balmy January morning. So,
yeah, it's like, what, 16 degrees outside?
Was it yesterday? It was 8 when I went for lunch yesterday, but I saw something about 15. Gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Yeah. I'm not complaining. Take the sunshine. Say goodbye to the rain.
I had a friend in Calgary, Bray, but it was the same temperature there, but we all know they're getting snow next week, probably.
Yeah,
so it's,
yeah,
we're
same,
like,
it was the same friend.
Yeah,
my favorite part about that was that he took a selfie in his car driving, making it look like he was driving.
Yeah,
did you notice that? To talk about the weather, like he took a selfie of himself and then clarified, "I was in my driveway, I wasn't driving," but he posed like he was driving.
Winner.
Like, classic. That's such a classic blank person move from that guy. I knew exactly who it was. Anyway, we love him. He's a brother. Good pastor. Welcome to the B-side. We got a question this week. Good question that we'll get to. Interesting topic on Sunday, Ezekiel 4 and 5. A lot of kind of hard things to swallow, in a sense, if you're just reading it blindly, but we'll dig into that. But something I read today, on Facebook, I honestly have to admit, I sometimes am attracted to those, like, ad, BuzzFeed, six celebrity couples that look alike, or like, and you just go like, what are they gonna say? Like, or like, just the random BuzzFeed articles. I sometimes, if you check my internet history, you probably find there's more than a few that I've clicked on. One that actually came up that I thought is funny, and I think most pastors would kind of agree, and as somebody who doesn't preach a lot in the sense of, you know, more than half of the Sundays of the year, I might preach 6 or 8 or 10 times in a year, I can relate to it, but somebody who preaches 40-ish times a year, I wanted to see what you thought, and it was six observations about speaking to your pastor right before they preach. And I'm sure, like, because Sunday is one of those times where, like, a parishioner may only see us right in that window, and they want to get it out, and it can be, hey, I don't know what to bring to the potluck on Sunday, or it could be, hey, I hate everything you're doing.
Yeah, so they're at home thinking, I should talk to Steve about that.
Right.
And they're like, oh, I will see him at 10:01 on Sunday. I can talk with him about that.
Without thinking really that, like, kind of what he would view as the most important part of his job is happening at 10:09.
Yeah.
Right? And so he had six observations, and for the most part, I thought they were all right, but here they were. First thing to remember is the time before a pastor preaches should be a time of prayerful focus for them, which is generally true, should be, not always is.
Yeah, that or going to the bathroom.
Yeah. Well, kind of just carrying final details.
Last minute things.
Yeah. Second one was, if you speak to the pastor at the time, consider giving him a word of encouragement or prayer support.
And there are people who, in our church, who, if I see them, like, you know, the first song is happening, prelude, we're about to go in, whatever. So I see someone, they'll give a little word of encouragement. They will. Okay. They'll say, like, praying for you or looking forward to, you know, and they're trying to be supportive in that time. So that's always appreciated. Always appreciate people's prayers. Massively important.
Yeah, that's good. And as somebody who doesn't preach a lot, I found a couple of times, same thing, where they'll see the mic.
Yeah.
Which is the telltale sign, you're the preacher for that Sunday. You're preaching this morning. Great. I'm looking forward to it. I think you're going to do great. Like,
little,
be praying for
you.
It's just like a little, like, go get him, champ. Number three, consider holding back any criticisms of your pastor right before the sermon. It feels like it should be a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Not always the case. I'm sure it's happened to you where you've had somebody just hammer you right before you got to go on, and you got to kind of shake it off and go up there and preach.
The best, when is the good time to talk to your pastor about something negative? I'd probably say, like,
Thursday afternoon?
Midweek?
Midweek, yeah.
Even because, like, sometimes I get, it's not bad now, but there's been seasons where Sunday afternoon, my wife would get mad at me. Did you check your email? Because Sunday afternoon is when people feel like that's open season a little bit too. Like, so now they're going to send critical emails about things you said or things you did or this went wrong. And you're already, like, it's amazing how fatiguing. It seems like a silly thing to complain about compared to a guy who did manual labor for 8 hours, but it's exhausting.
Yep.
And just, I think...
I generally sleep the afternoon.
Physically, yeah, exhausting. I'm always so hungry, tired. Often my muscles ache from just whether it's adrenal letdown or whatever it is. And, but mentally, spiritually...
Copious amounts of sitting.
Yeah. Exhausting. Yeah. And you're just, you're usually down. And the last thing you need is to, and my, I would probably not respond well.
Yeah.
What I usually do is I just don't check my email or ignore and deal with it later. So
I would say
later in the week, I've had some rest. I'm ready to like actually receive criticism and have a good conversation.
Yeah. I would say a pastor's probably at his most vulnerable on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah,
absolutely.
Like, I know when like, I can think of the times where I've hit the couple, maybe two or three seasons in my time where I've gotten massive criticism. Like there was a Sunday I remember I preached. Guy came after me like ferociously and meanly, and like I just went to my office and wept.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I'm not a crier, and like I wept for like 15 minutes because it was just like I was just done. And it was hard.
Often what you do is you're preaching on adrenaline,
right?
And so just you can study the actual like physiology of what's happening. Is you're up, so to speak.
Yeah.
Alert, high adrenaline, you're pouring your heart into it, energy for preaching, and the time right after, you're talking to people, praying with people, doing ministry is important, and your body's on full alert, you're feeling good.
You're at your best.
You're at your best, and that's the way God has made our bodies. It's the same response as you see a bear and you run, or, you know, you see whatever, a hockey game, the athletes, they're up for the, but then after is when your body crashes, the adrenaline runs out, and you feel the fatigue, and you feel down, and so there's, it's a energy up and down. It's an emotional up and down. So, you know, never quit your... It's a good rule for the pastor, right? You never quit your job on Sunday or Monday.
Yeah, or November if you live in the Lower Mainland. That's my rule. It's the time you feel the worst.
So it's probably not the best time to have a serious conversation.
Yeah, well, and it's hard because, like, generally, I don't know about you, but when you're preaching, you're of more than one mind. I always say, like, and it's non-preachers... People don't preach much, don't really understand what I'm saying, but, like... I always use the example, like, when you were preaching on Sunday, for example, there was a conversation you were having with us that you were speaking, but almost simultaneously, there's a separate conversation going on, at least one, in your own mind as you're picking up cues and you're reading the audience and you're thinking, oh, this might be something that, or the Spirit interjects. And so, like, it's this weird kind of, I always call it, like, this double-mindedness where you're, like, almost... And I think that's the part that wears me out the most anyway. But I don't do it a lot. So anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, number four. Consider holding back. This is my favorite one. Consider holding back your request of your pastor to make an announcement.
Yes.
No further explanation needed. Like, boom. Like,
oh, man. I get
there's nothing worse than, it doesn't matter what you're doing, than getting a, hey, can you make an announcement for knitting group like 3 minutes before the service?
Or what I get, what I've had happen, like 3 minutes after the service has started.
Right.
I don't even make announcements.
Right.
like Paul today, say, for instance, Paul's making announcements and he happens to be drumming. The guy you need to talk to about this is currently on stage and will be not coming off stage until he makes announcements. We're halfway through the first song and you come up to me and ask me to make an announcement. What am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
Can you send us an email on Wednesday?
Well, and part of it is understanding that, like, for us as pastors, we generally love the greeting part and don't love the announcement part. Announcement parts are hard anyway, trying to keep people engaged.
Sure.
Because you often have people that you're talking to but aren't affected at all by what you're... That's just why we try to keep our announcements pertaining to the whole church.
Yeah.
And we want that time to be short. We want people to, more than anything in that time, feel, hey, somebody's talked to me, they've welcomed me, I know who that guy is, and here's three ways I can be plugged in quickly.
And we really try hard, actually,
and it stalls, right?
We really take it seriously that we have gathered for worship. It's a worship service, not a news meeting.
Right,
So we try to keep, like, we could triple our announcements if we want.
Oh, easy, yeah.
And there's churches I've been to, I'm sure you've been to.
Yeah.
Where the announcement time feels like it's 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the sermon's 20. And you're like, we are gathered for worship. And unfortunately, because we're all in the same room, we actually do need to talk about a couple things as quick as possible and move on. Because
we want to keep 15 minutes or whatever it is focused on
preaching
God, and worship,
prayer,
and,
those things.
Because there's, the reality is we live in this culture where we go, well, duh. Like, it's almost a no-brainer in that when we think of the bazillion other avenues we have, from bulletin boards to snail mail to email, text, yeah. apps. Like, there's yeah. so many options that we for have for announcements yeah. for communicating, and we don't tend to do the same thing in the sense of worshiping together. We don't have other avenues often
worship together,
to gather yeah. and worship and hear the word together. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's valuable. Okay, last two. Consider asking someone else other than the preaching pastor, I'll insert that word there, to handle a problem right before the sermon. Boom. Yeah, of course. Like, we try to, like Paul and I, who generally aren't preaching, you are generally preaching, like, yeah. we'll always try to free you up. And generally, I think I've noticed our church is pretty good at that. Like,
yeah.
They kind of leave you kind of yeah. from that.
I haven't been asked to do any photocopying or something at 10:01.
Yeah, but I have.
You have.
Yeah, and that's fine. I don't mind. Like, I got a key. Sure. I'll help you out. Like, sure. If possible, this one. Consider introducing people to your pastor after the service as opposed
yeah.
to before.
Yeah, I don't think I've had that happen. I mean, I'm usually hanging out in the foyer, and I'm happy to meet someone if they come in.
Right.
What gets me is the band has started.
Right.
And I'm actually usually trying to find my wife and find my seat and make yeah. sure, you know, my throat is clear, glass of water, you know, and I'm ready to go, especially because our sermon comes so close after the music has started.
Right.
And I've got about 8 minutes before I'm on, and I just want to focus and worship and prepare yeah. my heart. And that's when people come up. Or, you know, one that's not on that list is I've had people come up.
I was going to ask you, is there any that you would include that aren't?
And give me a gift.
Right.
Like, yeah. like a Christmas gift.
Yeah.
As if, like, there's no other time for this but now. Or yeah, like, provide information for me. Like, did you know that this
someone
happened?
Passed
yeah,
away,
yeah. yeah.
Those
yeah.
are the worst, is that when you... And but sometimes... I mean, the reality is, this is one of those lists where you go, I think what the writer, a guy named Tom Rainer, is trying to point out, and I think we've experienced in our church here as well, but is just pause. Just pause for a second and think, can this wait?
Mm-hmm.
Is this yeah. and part of that is understanding that Sunday morning for a lot of people, you come to church and the pastor preaching is the normal method of how things go. It's in a sense, it's almost mundane that there would be a pastor, there'd be a sermon, because it's so normal. Not the mm-hmm. sermon's mundane, but just the process of how we do church.
Familiar. Yeah,
familiar. But for the preaching pastor, whoever it is, whether it's you or Paul or myself or a guest, like, whether we do it 5 times a year or 45 times a year, generally we are doing it like we're fired up. That's
focused,
like yeah. that's kind of the penultimate yeah. point of our week.
Yeah.
That everything that we've been preparing for and thinking about for the previous 6 days is kind of centered on that
yeah.
moment. So just
yeah.
use a little discretion, use a little discernment to think, okay, how can I handle this need? And sometimes mm-hmm. it's unavoidable. Like, I've been told of people's deaths minutes before I had to go preach, and like significant people in the church, and you know you're going to hear like the gasp, but
yeah.
but it's part of church life, and there's
yeah.
no avoiding it. But there's other times where, you know, I don't need to be told right before the church service that there's a red minivan in the parking lot with its lights on. Like, that's not, it's not my red
now,
minivan.
I'd reiterate though, like, a lot of those things would be happy to hear from you after. Like, I'd
yeah.
love to meet your friends.
Oh,
love
absolutely.
To,
yeah.
Love to answer your questions. You got a question about the message, you can email the B-side.
Yeah.
You can also just talk to me after and say, hey, but what about this verse?
Yeah.
I'm happy to do that. We're on a time limit. I can't say everything there is to say about a text. You want to take a strip off me? I'm a big man. I can take it. Let's
yeah.
do that after. You want to,
yeah.
you know, you want to ask a question about a ministry. You need help photocopying something. I can do, or we
yeah.
can do, all those
well,
things,
and
are happy to,
yeah.
not at 10:03.
Yeah, and I mean, the nice thing about a church like ours, and a lot of them, is that when you have more than one staff member, sometimes we can help in different ways. And so, you know, part of that is, it's just maybe like, let's put it this way. None of us who work here are in a hurry to leave on a Sunday.
No,
So, in the sense of going, like, unless there's, like our kid is sick or, like,
yeah.
whatever. Like, but generally, we're the last
yeah.
to leave. We
yeah.
lock up. And if that's at 12:15 or 2:15, it's not
yeah.
going to make a big deal.
It's unlimited time afterwards.
Yeah.
But,
limited
yeah.
time before. Yeah.
yeah.
I thought it was just interesting, and
yeah,
it's just something to think about. Anyway, as we carry on, good question that came in with respect to the sermon last week about the watchman. We talked a bit about it on the podcast last week about the accountability of the pastor to do the warning, and that God was essentially saying that that the if we do our job, so to speak, or Ezekiel in this case does his job, and the people do nothing, then he is absolved mm-hmm. of responsibility.
Yeah.
If he doesn't do his job and the people do nothing, he is not absolved of his responsibility. Yeah. And the question was, I'll just read it. It was commented on numerous times of the accountability of the watchman for those who were told the message and who perished as a result. So if the watchman is responsible, what is the consequence for the pastor or elder or whoever for not sounding the warning? So essentially,
what
specifically is the consequence? We've talked about judgment, talked about blood being on the hands of that person. What is what does that mean? What does that look like?
In Ezekiel itself, to start there, it's not entirely clear. Maybe death. It just says, for instance, his blood I will require at your hand, which is sort of a, maybe insinuates his, you're responsible for his death in some way. Hmm. So I do think, and we mentioned this in the text, that there's enough correlation between the watchman role and the role of elder, pastor, overseer in the New Testament that the truth of the watchman in Ezekiel's case, and other prophets were called watchmen as well, can be applied to the New Testament. And we even find similar language in Paul's ministry. And we mentioned Acts 20, verse 26 in the sermon. Therefore I testify to you this day that I am innocent of the blood of all of you, for I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole counsel of God. So that he's not innocent, or he is innocent of their blood, because he faithfully presented, proclaimed the message to them. In Acts 18:6, the Jews of Corinth, he's in Corinth. It says, when they, that's the Jews who opposed him, when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. Paul has faithfully done his job. The fact that they're rejecting his message, it's on them, not on him. So we do see that, but in what sense is the question, right? And I also think of James 3:1. Just flipping over there. Familiar passage, sobering. Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. Hmm. So we can still ask the same question that the listener is asking. What is that judgment?
Right.
So it doesn't tell us there, right? One other place that comes to mind is the beginning of Galatians. In Galatians 1, Paul's talking about the Judaizers who are not believers, though. Like, they would claim, like, they're Jewish people claiming to believe in, you need to believe in Jesus, but Jesus plus the law, circumcision, etc., in order to really be saved. And so they are heretics. They are outside. But this is what he says. Even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preached to you, let him be accursed. As we said before, so now we say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. So in that case, the person teaching is judged for their teaching, and Paul says, to hell with them. Mm. So there is a teaching, a wrong teaching, that is somehow connected to judgment. But in that case, it is a distortion of the gospel, a denying of the gospel. So I don't think that's the normal case. I mean, we're kind of dealing maybe with on the one extreme, like on a spectrum of bad teaching. That's the extreme.
So we have false teachers, and then we almost have ignorant teachers who are unwilling or unable to advocate warning or whatever.
The James 3:1, not many should be teachers because they're going to be judged more strictly, is a different situation than Galatians 1. Galatians 1 is someone who is teaching opposite of the gospel, and Paul says to hell with them. Let them be accursed. So what about the James 3:1, judged with greater strictness? Well, what does, in what sense is a Christian teacher, believes the gospel, but does not teach faithfully, is that a loss of salvation? Is it what? In what sense are they being judged if there's no condemnation in Christ?
Hmm.
So, and to that, I think we go to 1 Corinthians 3, because it'll maybe be helpful. So here's verse 10 to 15. According to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation and someone else is building upon it. He's using a metaphor for ministry in the church. Let each one take care how he builds upon it. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw. So the first three of those are valuable, strong resources for building. The last three are weaker, wood, hay, straw. He's going in kind of in order. Each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. Okay, so everyone's building, doing ministry, whether a lay ministry or a apostolic ministry like Paul or the elders and teachers there. They're all doing ministry, they're all building. And the work that they're doing is like building a house, right. A building. But not everyone is building with the same resources. Some people are building with gold, silver, precious stones, which will last through the fire. Some are building with wood, hay, straw, which will burn up in the fire. And so the fire of judgment is at the end. It's not the fire of hell, but it's that God will evaluate the work
right.
of those who worked in his kingdom, in his church.
Which is funny, though, because if you think, like, this is the thing that stood out to me, and you pointed to it, which helped. There actually is an order yeah. to, like, gold won't burn, silver won't burn, precious stones may, but they'll burn slower. Wood
strong,
will burn, but
burn.
You know, if a house burns down, sometimes the structure will still yeah. be there. And then hay, not as fast as straw. Like, straw will light up and be gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hay, if you light a hay bale on fire, it'll take some time to wither it away.
So everyone's building. And in fact, the buildings might look the same.
And there's levels to, yeah. yeah.
So I think the you can push a metaphor too far, but I think this is the point, is that...
And if there's someone who's going to do that, it's probably me.
We're all building.
Yeah.
And we're all doing ministry work. And in fact, the buildings might look the same. Like the two buildings in the end of the Sermon on the Mount, the right. wise and foolish builders,
yeah, yeah.
The buildings look the same, yeah. but the foundation is different. One gets destroyed, one doesn't. It's a similar image.
Yeah.
So you're building a building, but they use different materials, but maybe you have two good-looking buildings. They both seem good. And then there's the fire of judgment. Not judgment meaning hell, but judgment meaning evaluation. God's going to look at the end of all things and evaluate, examine, and the day will disclose it. On that day, it will be revealed who built with what. See, I think today we might see guys that are very successful, but maybe they're only building with straw. And there'll be other guys that nobody's ever heard of, but they were building with gold. And you can't tell at this day. You will the coming day, will disclose it. It may be surprising
right.
who built faithfully, and on that day it's revealed that this guy who nobody ever heard of, who faithfully served in his church and ministered well, he was actually building with gold or silver, and some other guy, which everyone's read his books, was actually building with straw, and it got burnt up on that day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so God evaluates, and the fire sort of evaluates and tests your
right.
work, your ministry work. And so the guy whose work survives, it says he will receive a reward.
Right.
His faithful, sacrificial.
Beyond his salvation.
Beyond his
salvation.
So
right.
he'll be rewarded.
In addition to. Right.
Then verse 15, if anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. So what this indicates is, the work he did was shoddy work. It might have looked nice now, but in the end it was shoddy. And it got burnt up. When human evaluation, it looked great. God's evaluation, the fire, it was straw. It went up in seconds. There was nothing left. He will not be rewarded. He suffers loss. I think the loss of reward, contrasting with the faithful
right.
builder who gets
yep.
the reward. And his work is burned up, though he himself will be saved. There's no loss of salvation here for the shoddy right. Christian worker, but only as through fire, meaning he survives the fire. The fire, it's not hellfire. This is still the image of the burning up the building, God's evaluating judgment fire.
Okay, so he's not saved as a result of the fire.
Nope.
He's saved in spite.
Through the fire, meaning fire. He escapes.
Right.
The building goes up, but he will live. So
the work is wasted, but his life is not.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, so the question was, okay, you got a Christian guy, Christian pastor, say, Bible teacher, and he is an unfaithful watchman. He doesn't faithfully do the tasks that God has called him to. He's done work, Christian work, but it's shoddy work. He's building with straw. In the end, God will evaluate it. It'll get burned up. He will still be saved because he's saved by God's grace, not by his effective ministry work. We are saved by God's grace. His trust in Jesus Christ, which is always true of this hypothetical person we just made up. But his work was shoddy. It will be wiped out. He will not be rewarded because he was not faithful in his work. However, he always believed in Jesus and will be saved.
Right.
So the question was, what is the consequence?
Right.
It's not clear in general. Like in all these passages, James 3, it doesn't say that what the stricter judgment is. Ezekiel doesn't specifically come out and say it. But that there is a responsibility that comes with teaching, with the role of prophet in the Old Testament, with the role of teaching doctrine in the New Testament, the role of elder, shepherd, pastor, overseer, everyone has a spiritual responsibility, and those who teach have a greater spiritual responsibility before God. And at least 1 Corinthians 3 indicates that at least there's a loss of reward. Galatians 1 would warn us. So 1 Corinthians 3, a Christian who does shoddy work, loss of reward, still saved. Galatians 1 is a guy who doesn't just do shoddy work, is denying the gospel, and he himself, in the end, won't be saved. And I don't think that's ignorance. I think that's a defiance of the gospel, intentionally going around contradicting the gospel that Paul teaches.
Right.
So there is some teachers who are rejecting the gospel and are defiant in it, a pretty extreme case, indicate that they're not really saved at all. Others who are not faithful teachers, but they're still believers, their work will be evaluated, and they'll have a loss of reward. There'll be consequences. They'll still be saved. God's grace will still come to them. Yeah. So I think that's probably the way I would look at it. And so it's something that's a little sobering. You have to take the responsibility for. God is holding everyone. Responsibility with what they've been called to.
Right.
Hopefully
so
helps.
We don't know what the consequence is, but we probably don't want to know.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's not necessarily... you're not going to lose your salvation for not warning, but you will be held accountable. And it's in a lot of ways, I think of it like just the illustration of like, if you have people walking blindfolded toward a cliff and you can see, there is a moral right to...
Yeah.
To warn them, and if you don't, you are culpable in their death, right? Like, it's the same kind of idea.
Parents can get charged with neglect.
Right.
Under our criminal law.
Yeah.
For failing. You didn't do anything wrong. You failed to do something.
Yeah. You just chose. Yeah.
Or leaving the scene of a crime, or not helping somebody. You can get charged with crimes of failing to do something.
Yeah. Failure of the Good Samaritan law.
Anyway. And then the same is, true spiritually. We have a responsibility. Yeah.
That's good. So Sunday's sermon was...
long. Were you going to say long?
I was going to say long. It was good. It was a challenging text, I think, in the sense of a lot of content, a lot of ways you can go, a lot of things to highlight and to clarify. And one of the things that stood out to me, at least, was in verse 10 of chapter 5. So you did chapter 4 of Ezekiel and chapter 5. Went through all of it, and verse 10 said, "Therefore fathers," and talking about the judgment, "shall eat their sons in your midst, and sons shall eat their fathers, and I will execute judgment on you, and any of you who survive I will scatter to all the winds." Now, I thought of that, and my first inclination was, what picture is he painting? And so the question that I thought was, is this an illustration that Ezekiel is using, or God is using his judgment? Is it an analogy? It's like this, but it's going to look like this? Or is this reality? Is this like, is he actually saying, like, you are going to be so broken, so deplorable, so, you know, awful, that what's actually going to happen is you're going to become cannibals. Hmm. Not only cannibals, cannibals who eat their kin, like their family. Yeah. It's like a disgusting image.
I think it's literal. Yeah. Because, and this is in ancient accounts of siege, that's the point you get to, right? Is you starve them out. That's right. The point of siege warfare is if there's a city that is well fortified, and like Jerusalem was a well fortified city. I've not been there, but maybe some of our listeners have visited Jerusalem, and its location on where it is. It's, I think, historical accounts and what I was reading this week, a well fortified city, just based on location and the walls. And so you know you can't take the city, so you hold a siege. You cut off their food supply. And you wait them out, and you just camp out, watch them. They can't escape. Eventually, they run out of food. Ezekiel was modeling that with his, his 8 ounces of bread, diet, whatever. Yeah. It's a little bit of bread he ate. Is that you're going to be anxious about your food and only able to eat a small amount. You're on a near-starvation diet. Eventually, the food runs out, and you can either surrender or you turn on each other. And you start to kind of lose your mind, I think. I read the book Unbroken. Yeah. And they get lost at sea for 44 days with no food. They catch some fish here and there, like picking them out of the sea, actually. Yeah. Eat raw fish. But eventually, you know, the book mentions that some people who had been lost at sea like that actually did resort to cannibalism.
Don't you remember the movie Alive when we were, when we were kids? It was about a plane crash in the Alps. And a ski team or a sporting team, and many survived, and they started to eat those who didn't.
So in Unbroken, they don't. They refused, and even the one guy dies, and they just bury him at sea. They let him go, and they don't eat him. But that was sort of on the minds, because your body is so hungry. And this is what's happening in a siege, is you're so hungry that they even resort to the most evil thing I could imagine, which would be eating your own kin, your own family.
Right.
This was one of the things that God did warn them of in Leviticus 26, is under the Leviticus 26:29, that there would be a siege as a consequence of their, if they disobeyed to this great extent, where things got so bad that they would resort to cannibalism. Lamentations 4:10 seems to indicate, you know, Lamentations, Jeremiah's writing after the fall of the city. So after the events, like he's writing a little bit after this. And it says there that the hands of compassionate women have boiled their own children. They became their food during the destruction of the daughter of my people. So that seems to indicate that, in fact, yes, during the Jerusalem siege, some people did resort to cannibalism just to survive. And so you get a picture. I mean, it's the most awful image you can...
Yeah. But it paints a picture of both desperation and being deplorable. I didn't read it in the sense of desperation as much as I read it in the sense of just like broken, kind of so far from disobedience.
It's the very last step in a siege, right? Yeah. Is you have run out of food, you've run out of water, you've run out of options, and do you then kill each other to eat something, or do you surrender to the enemy who will maybe kill you or take you off?
Yeah.
So there's a good chance that this literally actually did happen to some people.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
It's absolutely awful.
So in a reading like this, you can read Ezekiel 4 and 5. And one of the questions that we got was about kind of how God comes across in these passages, is that, and even in the first bits of Ezekiel, I had somebody say to me, like, God kind of comes across as kind of cruel. And I could tell the person didn't want to paint that picture of God, because that's not their experience of an understanding of who God is. But so how do we as Christians then read passages like this in contrast to passages that talks about, you know, He is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. Like, how do we hold Ezekiel 4 and 5 with the psalmist's, like, poetic love offering is about the character and nature of God in position of contrast to one another, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's important to read each passage in the Bible in its context. Of course, it's the most, you know, we've mentioned before, the three rules of Bible interpretation, context, context, context. And so to not develop a picture of God based on one chapter, any one chapter, you end up with a distorted view, because I think there's a lot of balance, tension in God, that he is both gracious and just. He's loving and he's holy. And each of these things not diminishing the other. And so we can end up...
He is like us and he is other, right? Like,
yeah, so you can have these things in some sort of tension, in some sort of balance, that they're both true at the same time. So... we have to read, so Ezekiel 4 and 5, as our current example, God does seem a little bit harsh. I mean, he's going to punish them badly, that he's coming against his own people. So we have to put it in the context of Ezekiel. And I kind of even mentioned to a couple people on Sunday, Ezekiel is like a movie story where it starts off with a big beginning, grabs your attention, what's going on, and starts off with gives a mission to the main character. And this insurmountable problem he has to face. And then he goes through a series of challenges, and there's some dark periods. And in the end, there's breakthrough, victory, and everything ends up really glorious. So that means it's a lot of movies, right? Where you kind of see the plot line. So in some ways, it'd be better if we read Ezekiel in one sitting. But that's a lot. But right now, like Ezekiel 4 and 5 is a dark chapter. Like any movie, there's a dark scene where, you know, everything seems to be falling apart, everything's going on. And in fact, it's because of the dark scenes that the light scenes at the end are so beautiful. You know, if there was a movie where it's just happiness the whole way through, we call that a kid's show. It's not that entertaining. We like the conflict, the drama, the challenge, the setbacks, and the things that go horribly wrong and then break through and become glorious and good. And they're all that more good because things were once broken before that. And that, in some ways, is the story of the Bible. That is the story of the world that we live in. And that's the story of individual books like Ezekiel. That this world is filled with broken, ugly, horrible things. But things will be right in the end. And they'll somehow be better and more glorious and more beautiful for having been broken.
Right.
Along the way. So we have to read Ezekiel, the book, in its context. That there is dark chapters.
Yeah.
But there is good that grace is coming. It's one story, and we're in a dark chapter where God is against his people. But in the second half of the book, once he breaks them of their pride, God is for his people in an unbelievably gracious and glorious and good way that redeems and restores. So if that's all you read, don't just read chapter 4 and then give up. Because... Right. You have to keep reading and see what else God has to say. You also have to read it in a historical context. That God is not just capriciously
vengeful,
taking out his anger on random innocent people, overreacting.
Yeah.
You have to put it in the context of, for 800 years, God warned them, this is what would happen if you disobey.
Yeah.
And then for 400 years, while they were rebelling against him, he sent prophets. He didn't send justice. He sent prophets to warn them, to appeal to them, to call them. He is working with these people for centuries, doing everything he can to turn them, to change them, to have them repent. That it's not like, you know, they made one little mistake and then God, you know, pounded them. You have to put it in the context of the painfully long journey of God's patience, forbearance, putting up with them, sending them prophets, showing them grace, showing them mercy, giving them another chance. And eventually things do reach a culmination, and this is it, the final siege. But I think that, you know, the verse you quoted, he's slow to anger. Mm. That's true here.
Yeah,
we just saw the end.
Yeah.
We're reading the passage that, you know, slow to anger doesn't mean he doesn't anger. It means he's very, very patient, and eventually, though, he will anger.
Yeah.
We read the anger, and let's just remember that it's 400 years of people fighting against God. We're going to see just how wicked they are. Like in the next week's sermon, you find out what they're doing, where they're in the temple, they're worshiping Babylonian gods and deities. Like, the level of idolatry and rebellion is extremely shocking. And God is still patiently, and after the judgment will come restoration.
Well, and, so, you know, on the flip side of it, I go, in that context of understanding that, like, it's been 800 years since this was an obedient people, and even then it was touch and go, in a sense, like, what, part of me just, like, and I think you and Ro touched on it in the bumper video, is, like, what does it say about God if he does nothing?
Yeah.
And what does it say about God if he acts? Like,
yeah.
In both in the context, in the conflict of the book, was that his glory is his kavah, right? His is that
kavod.
The right word? Kavod. Ah, one letter off is kind of could be diminished, compromised, yeah. Diminished somehow by doing nothing or by doing something. And yeah. Ezekiel kind of speaks to that. So next week should be interesting. And
so that is, I mean, the other thing I'd say about this: you're reading the Old Testament, and whether it's reading like the Canaanite, like the Joshua going in and wiping out. These passages which seem kind of harsh. We have to put it in its context. We also have to put it in the context of the whole Bible.
Right.
And that which is what I tried to do on Sunday, where we looked at God's anger, and it has, the right way to read the Old Testament is it has to point us to Christ.
Right.
Jesus told us, Luke 24, he's with the disciples. He says, he interprets to them all the scriptures, how they all apply, point to him. He says it's all about him. Prophets, law, whole Old Testament is all about Jesus. And so we know that if we are reading the Old Testament correctly, it will lead us to Jesus. If you're reading it incorrectly, you're just stuck in the Old Testament. If you don't arrive at Jesus somehow.
You're Jewish.
So, you're reading it wrong. It's a misinterpreted. The right way that God intended for us to read Ezekiel is we have to get to Jesus. So we're trying to draw those connections. So God is angry, but his anger is fully satisfied at the cross. So you have to get there, right? So in the tougher Old Testament passages, we'll learn something about God's holiness, about his justice. But we also have to go, what does this tell us about Christ and what he did for us? So you're reading about Leviticus and how this, you know, sacrifices and blood being shed, that tells us something about Jesus. So we don't read, I think if you read the Old Testament on its own in isolation, you just sit down and read Ezekiel 4 and 5 and nothing else, you end up with a harsh or lopsided view of God. So read it in the context of the rest of the book, but read it in the context of Christ. And that's the right way to read the Old Testament. It'll teach us something about Christ. The justice of God exacted on Christ. His holiness that tells us about Christ and the cross. It always has to arrive at Christ. He's the true prophet. He's the true sacrifice. He's the true temple. He's our true priest. He's our true king. And so the right way to read it is to sit back and go, what is this? How does this point us towards Jesus?
Right.
Yeah.
It was great. A lot of content, a lot of things we've covered today. If you have questions for the B-side, we'll be doing this again next week. We'd love to hear them. Love to try to get at them. B-side@TawasinAlliance.org or talk to Steve or talk to myself in person, just not before, right before we preach.
Yeah, after.
Or send us an email at our personal email. Either way, if you got something that's on your mind, whether it pertains to Ezekiel or something else in general, we'd love to take a stab at it. But thanks for listening, and I hope you stuck with us. Have a good one.
See ya.